Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.net, movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm super excited tonight to play Russian Roulette with my old war buddy, JB.
Patrick, you see this? This is this. This isn't anything else. It isn't anything besides this. This is this, and that's what I keep telling you. This is this.
Brilliant, sir. We're going to be talking about The Deer Hunter from 1978 because JB hates me, and he had a pick of a few movies, and he said the deer. I say he hates me because it's very long. That movie's very, very long.
And here's where I make out like a bandit. On some basic, though HD cable channel, it's been playing pretty much nonstop for the last 2 months.
Really?
And whenever I chance upon it, I can't stop watching it. So literally, in the last 2 months, I think I've seen it 5 times.
Holy cow.
I really like it.
I think this was only my second time seeing it ever, but we'll get to that.
I believe it's a masterpiece. I think it's one of the few times where the Academy got it right.
We will get, well, this answers the first question I was going to ask you when we got to that part. We're going to talk about what we've seen lately. We're going to talk about The Deer Hunter, but of course, first I have to remind you guys that coming up on Saturday, February 13th, is our 5th annual F This Movie Fest, the world's
so exciting.
Only all Twitter film festival. Go to fthismovie.net. Up at the top in the tabs there, we have a section for F This Movie Fest 5. Check it out. This year, we're celebrating the movies of 1984, so we're going to be watching and tweeting during The Last Starfighter, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, Night of the Comet, Streets of Fire, and Ghostbusters to finish it off.
We watch and we tweet. It's the definition of schizophrenia.
It's a ton of fun if you've never done it. If you have done it, you know it's fun and you can't wait to join us again, whether it's for one movie or all the movies. We really want to have as many people as possible participating. So make sure you go to fthismovie.net and check out everything about F This Movie Fest.
If you're really into it, watch the 5 movies with us, tweet, and then when it's done, start the first movie again, watch all 5 of them again, and continue to tweet. That would be something.
That would be something. That would be something. Anyway, so that's coming up, and we'll talk a little bit more about that next week for the last time, and then it'll be the festival. So, Jay Bones, have you seen anything good lately?
Well, I saw something interesting lately. My curiosity and
not what I asked.
My curiosity and my love of Westerns drove me to see Jane Got a Gun.
Yes.
And I was vaguely aware of production problems, but I didn't read anything
there
about it.
There were several.
Because I wanted to approach it fresh. And I went, and it was so odd. My wife was the only woman in the theater. There were only about 10 or 12 of us. During the film, at least 5 men walked out.
Really?
Which was odd. You can tell that there was a lot of post-production canoodling. I think it's worth seeing. It's certainly not the greatest Western I've ever seen, but it's interesting. And then after I saw it, I read about the replacement of the director. Michael Fassbender was supposed to be in it. Joel Edgerton was originally supposed to be the bad guy. And when Jude Law dropped out, he slid over, became the good guy.
Wasn't Christian Bale in there at some point,
no,
too? Okay.
And then they got Ewan McGregor to play the bad guy. But spoiler alert, with Ewan McGregor, it's very much Christian Bale in The Big Short syndrome, that if you sit through Jane Got a Gun, you're very aware of the fact that Ewan McGregor isn't in it very much. In fact, it's pretty much 2 scenes. So it's very much, okay, I'll give you a week.
So what you're saying is he's a lock for an Oscar nomination.
In today's crazy world, who knows? I think it's worth seeing. There's some really interesting things going on. It's certainly very beautiful to look at, as are most Westerns, and I was glad that I got to see it on a big screen. But it's interesting and mediocre. Given the production problems, it's sort of amazing that they were able to cobble a film together at all.
Yeah, right.
And I think there were some script problems, and the script is credited to someone that I had never heard of, and then the word "and," which means they didn't work together, and then someone else and Joel Edgerton. So I think at some point Joel Edgerton did a rewrite.
Okay. I want to see it still. I didn't have a chance to this weekend, and I'm guessing it will be gone by the end of this week.
Lately, there's a habit I have to get rid of, that I'll see something that's really worthwhile, and because I have a little quibble with it, I'll hesitate to recommend it to other people. But lately, I've been thinking how shitty the average movie is.
Right.
So why on earth would I not recommend The Revenant? Because you need to see that.
Sure.
You know, fuck my little, again, quibble. What do you want that person to see, especially on a big screen? Oh, no, you want to skip The Revenant. I have a problem with the last 10 minutes. Go see Sisters. So should you see Jane Got a Gun? Yes.
Sure. Yeah, right. All right. Well, that's cool. Have you by any chance, did you see Western that came out a few weeks ago on VOD called The Keeping Room?
No.
It's worth seeing.
Who's in it?
Britt Marling, Sam Worthington, Haley Steinfeld, and maybe two other actors. It's very small. And but again, also a Western that's focused on women.
It's available cable VOD.
Yes, and possibly out on Blu-ray like next week.
Because lately, Patrick has a great winning streak of recommending things that maybe didn't get a wide release. And I'm thinking Bone Tomahawk, of course. But then I'm going back to The Homesman.
Yeah.
Which was so incredible.
Yeah.
How did that not get...
Disappeared. Just disappeared. Nobody talks about it.
You'd think Tommy Lee Jones alone would be... My God.
No, he didn't... have a disability. So anyway, I'll talk about two movies, and they're both older movies that I just saw for the first time. One was Blue Thunder, which I had never seen, and I believe has existed in my head for my entire life. One as that helicopter movie, and two as, and I might have this wrong, the first rated R movie my brother ever saw. So it was like this thing where I was like, you've seen Blue Thunder, and I haven't.
Well, it was sold as the helicopter movie. I remember when that came out. I can't help you in terms of your personal family history.
Well, sometimes I confuse it with a movie called White Fire, which my uncle in Missouri one time put on for us. Like, they just got in a VCR, and he was like, kids, we're going to watch White Fire. Have you ever seen White Fire?
No.
Robert Ginty and Fred Williamson. An arm gets cut off with like a buzzsaw in the first 5 minutes, and that's when my parents said, I don't think the kids should watch White Fire.
Is this about two Vietnam vets?
I believe so. Maybe like a diamond heist on the ocean or something. There's a boat. It's been a long time.
Okay, we got 1 minute for a tangent?
Of course.
At some point in high school, I go downtown with a friend, and we're just walking around.
The Exterminator. Don't confuse it with The Exterminator.
Oh, no. The Exterminator came out when I was in college.
Okay. Because that's Vietnam Vets and Robert Ginty.
and I love that movie. What Happens to the Bad Guy? That's poetry. That's canon poetry.
He overreacts.
The Exterminator comes out when I'm in college, and I begin to conflate two different things. The fact that I'm in love with The Exterminator and a Saturday Night Live sketch. So I begin to think that the theme song in the Saturday Night Live sketch was actually in The Exterminator. He kills because he has to, not because he wants to.
That's like not far off, though, from the themes. Like, The Exterminator has a weird soft rock theme song that's so at odds with the fucking insane brutality that's just in the first 5 minutes of that movie. Like,
it's
the most
crazy.
Realistic beheading you've ever seen.
In The Exterminator, someone takes to someone else with where you make the wood brown. It looks like a pencil.
It's a brand? Like a branding?
No. What do you call
make
that?
Make the wood brown.
It's late, folks. It's late and I'm old. Like a wood burning kit?
Like a poker? Like a, what do you...
You plug it in.
Okay.
And it's you make decorative things on wood.
Oh, all right.
And someone dips that... I can't get
this. I don't remember
out of my,
this.
In The Exterminator. Someone dips that in like Vaseline and like is going to burn someone with it. Back to the original tangent. My buddy and I wander around Chicago and we end up at the McVickers Theater, which then was sort of a grindhouse. And we said, what the hell, let's go in. And it was gross. and really, really long in the tooth and gross carpeting and pinball machines out in the lobby that you could hear inside the theater. And the inside of the theater was bum motel because they showed movies 24 hours a day.
Right.
And we sat down and the movie started and there's two guys in Vietnam. And in the first 10 minutes, the black guy gets it really explicit, like one of the most violent things I had seen up to that time. And then the white guy gets out of the army and he goes to the neighborhood where the black guy lived. And he's like, he wants to tell everyone what happened and say how sorry he was and everything. And they like, they become radicalized by this and they kill the white guy. They shoot him. And my friend and I, this is like a scene in Animal House. We look around and I say, we're the only white people in the theater. And just like Animal House, we got up and it was like, and we ran out of there. Feats, do your duty.
Mind if we dance with your dates?
But when you say Robert Ginty, my eyes light up.
Oh,
because,
yeah.
Oh, Robert Ginty.
Oh, boy. It's like someone's dad became an action hero.
Yeah, very much. So, you know who he's like on the original TV show Chips? There was Eric Estrada.
And
he
the
was
other guy?
The other guy.
Yeah,
what? Is he a contest winner?
How is Chips a TV? We're so far off base.
That was on for a long time.
I know. So I was watching MeTV Saturday night because they run Star Trek and then Son of Svengoolie. And before that was Wonder Woman, which I was watching with my daughter, who's now obsessed with spinning around and turning into Wonder Woman, a la Linda Carter, which does segue into the next thing I'm going to talk about. And there's a commercial for Chips, and I watched it. Like, and I remember watching it as a kid. But
because that's on MeTV.
How was this a show? I don't know.
I don't know how to get episode out of episode. Did you watch This Island Earth on Svengoolie?
No, I did not.
Lately, I've been recording Svengoolie on the DVR in order to skip the commercials. It's always a movie I've seen, so I actually watch it just for his segments.
The bits, right?
And you can watch it in like 20 minutes nice. And then get on with your life.
That's how I watch Colbert. So Blue Thunder was fine. Like, I didn't love it. I enjoyed enough of it. I was happy to see actors show up. Like, there's Daniel Stern, very young. There's Warren Oates. And Roy Scheider, you know, I grew up just, he's the guy from Jaws.
Mm.
And he just was always like one of these dad actors to me. Like, he's this older white guy who is generic. And the older I get, the more I realize how fucking awesome Roy Scheider is in everything.
Yeah.
And I just want to track down movies with Roy Scheider.
French Connection, 52
Sorcerer.
Pickup,
yeah.
Sorcerer, and All That Jazz.
Which I've never seen.
Which I'm the biggest All That Jazz fan. Is Blue Thunder John G. Alvinson?
I want to say it's John Badham.
That's right. You're right.
But those two are easily mixed up
in name as well as style.
Yeah. So it was okay. And then the other movie I saw for the first time, speaking of Linda Carter, is Bobby Joe and the Outlaw.
Oh yeah,
which was a ton of fun. Belinda Bulaski shows up. I grew up thinking Linda Carter was pretty because she was Wonder Woman, but now I'm a grown man and I'm just like, how did anyone stand to be in the room with Linda Carter? She's insanely beautiful. On the Blu-ray, one of the actresses who acted opposite her, not Belinda Bulaski, the blonde one whose name is not coming to me, doesn't have super nice things to say about Linda Carter, though. She suggests that there was a lot of competition there. And the lead actor of Bobby Joe and the Outlaw,
I'm trying to remember. It's coming to me.
Marjo
Gortner.
Speaking of, how did this person have a career? Anytime he pops up and stuff, I cannot wrap my head around the casting agent who thought...
He was an evangelical preacher and the subject of a documentary that got a lot of good reviews called Marjo.
Okay.
And then he slowly ponied that into a Hollywood career. He is the weirdest part in Earthquake. It doesn't make any sense. It's like they conflated two different parts in the script stage to one. He's this guy who's kind of a psycho, and then he hides his curly hair under a wig, and then he's in the National Guard. It's just, what, did I fall asleep and miss something here?
Every time I see him, I just feel like William Catt fucked a condor. I'm just like, and it made Marjo Gortner. He's a weird looking dude, and but man, that movie was a ton of fun.
Yeah.
It was, you know, one of those Bonnie and Clyde ripoffs that AIP made in the 70s, but well worth anyone's time as a fan of the
Dirty
drive-in.
Dirty Larry and Crazy Mary?
Much like Dirty Larry and Crazy. Dirty, yeah. Dirty
I can
Mary,
never
crazy
remember
Larry.
Which one's dirty
She's
and which
dirty,
one's
he's crazy.
Crazy.
No, wait.
I think both of dirty. Them are both crazy and dirty, but that's because I've seen the film.
I enjoyed that movie. I like all those Bonnie and Clyde ripoffs. Anyway, so that's what I've seen. Let's talk about the Deer Hunter. So this was going to be my first question to you, and I already know the answer because of the way. But is the Deer Hunter a great movie?
I think it is.
Okay.
And
I can't decide.
Looking back or watching it, because I've seen it innumerable times, but a week or two ago I watched it again, and my first impression is movies in the 70s, what the hell was going on? They're about something.
Yeah.
They have sweep. Yeah. They have something to say. They have amazing performances and a script that like someone worked out so that it's not just, and right. then this happens, and right. then this happens.
Right.
And I think we may have talked about this before, but I think the 70s was the last flowering of a certain something because HBO has been showing this... Godfather re-edit lately.
Right.
They took 1 and 2 and cut them back into chronological order. And it's a little bit like something Coppola did for NBC years and years ago, but it's actually different and has more new footage. And you just watch that and you think there used to be a sizable audience for this, but they're all dead now. I recognize why some people criticize The Deer Hunter. And there was a time when I had a bit of a problem with it, but I think I've gotten over that. When it came out, it faced a firestorm of criticism because apparently the Russian roulette stuff did not happen in Vietnam.
Does that matter?
I don't think it does.
Is the movie explicitly about Vietnam?
I think it is explicitly about Vietnam, but okay. I think I... see where you're going. I think the scriptwriter, and actually it's also Cimino, he's come up with a metaphor
right
for war.
Right.
And I think it's only sort of people with tunnel vision and a certain type of person who's like, well. But won't you admit that the main Russian roulette scene, the one in
the first
hut, the water, is just one of the most nerve-wracking, harrowing things you've ever seen.
Of course, yeah. Yeah, okay. So part of me wonders if the movie is even completely about Vietnam. To me, it's more about that time in American history. Vietnam certainly being a big part of it.
No,
but
I think the film supports that
the
interpretation
time when
as well.
Everything... fell apart and communities were split up and devastated. And
that's why we spend so much time at the beginning
right.
in this town.
Right.
Because that sequence is crazy long.
Right.
But I think it's really, really important.
Well, again, only in the 70s, right? And that's what I thought the whole time as I watched this, that no movie ever again would be allowed that much time. You know, it gets classified as a Vietnam movie because obviously that factors in greatly. But when you think about it, there are very few sequences in Vietnam and most of them are kind of the Russian roulette stuff. So it's not a movie that's like trying to show you what the experience was like necessarily in terms of the day to day of Vietnam, the way Platoon might be about that.
True.
Because really all we see is that sequence. So. To me, it doesn't bother me as much. Now, maybe that's disrespectful to the people who were there and are like, hey, no one made us play Russian roulette. That's bullshit. You're fabricating stuff. So I'm not trying to say, like, they can do whatever they want. But because I don't read the movie as this explicit, like, this is what Nam was like, man, the Russian roulette doesn't bother me.
Okay, in that sense, I agree with you because you had mentioned Platoon, and I would bring up Apocalypse Now. I don't think Deer Hunter is as explicitly about Vietnam as either Apocalypse Now or Platoon. But I give Cimino a lot of credit for sort of getting to it in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, as far as I'm concerned, not using any of the cliches and tropes
right.
of standard war films. It's a very interesting way to go about it.
Yeah, the only...
And the structure of the film is so interesting.
The only cliche that I think it sort of embraces is this notion of the promise between De Niro and Walken. Yeah. I'll never leave you, I'll never leave you, you know. But then the movie even really inverts that, because then it says, yeah, but when you follow through on that promise and when you do go back for him, like, look what you're coming back to, you yeah. know. So it's not this, like, heroic moment of like Chuck Norris going back to rescue the POWs, or you know, in Rambo or whatever, you know, no, every other version of it we've seen.
In a way, the scene where De Niro goes back is both startling but also sort of a shrug, and it's kind of a metaphor for our disillusion
right.
with sort of standard heroism tropes that right. really didn't apply to Vietnam in a lot of cases. I used to really admire this film for its interesting structure, although you could just say, well, it's a three-act structure. And then a couple months ago, or was it years ago, I wrote a column about Heaven's Gate.
Yes.
Which, of course, everyone shit on and put Cimino in movie jail. And my guess, and I wanted to ask you about this. Deer Hunter comes out, and yes. it's a sensation.
Right.
It's lauded to the high heavens. It wins the Oscar for Best Picture. And then 4 years later, he makes another film, and I would argue that Heaven's Gate is also a masterpiece, and that's not how it's received.
No.
And people are reviewing the budget, and there's this book that says that everyone was crazy and stuff, but do you think the Times had anything to do with this? Because Deer Hunter comes out in 78... which is the last gasp right. of 70s personal filmmaking.
Right, right.
And then Heaven's Gate comes out in 1980, which is a very different time.
And it's only 2 years difference.
Think about if Heaven's Gate had come out in 1975.
Right. Right. Now, I've never seen Heaven's Gate. Oh. I've seen the first hour, and I love the first hour, and I haven't seen the rest. So I'm going to sit down and watch the whole thing beginning to end, but I want to make that commitment. So the version that was released is not the version that you wrote about, right? The one on the Criterion Blu-ray.
True, because very early on, after the first few screenings, the studio stepped in
right.
and played scissor games.
So that may have something to do with the reception at the time.
True, although, well, first of all, like I said, people were reviewing the budget, but also I think they were responding to the slowness of it,
because
right. I'm not going to suggest that it's the most peppy film.
But either is The Deer Hunter.
But when I wrote the column about Heaven's Gate, one of the few insights I came up with that was sort of, oh, I've never read this before. This might be original to me. The structure of Heaven's Gate is exactly the same as the structure of The Deer Hunter.
Oh.
In The Deer Hunter, we start in a very specific place, and we establish what this community is like through a social ritual, a wedding. And then we go someplace else that's way different, that serves to underline the difference
right.
between the two cultures.
Right.
And then at the end, we go back for a sad, short, disillusioned coda.
Okay.
And in Heaven's Gate, we start with a graduation
right.
at Harvard.
I've seen that.
Full of ritual and the dancing and the tree thing.
Yeah.
And it's so weird. And then we go out to the wilderness, and things are a lot different, and the rules have all changed. And Heaven's Gate, and this is not a spoiler, has a small, sad shrug of a coda. So this is a structure that Cimino really likes.
Yeah. I mean, I think Heaven's Gate has been rediscovered in recent years. I think people are finally saying, like, oh, wait. Once Z Channel started airing the long version, I think people started saying, like, oh, wait, there's something here.
Yeah, you need to watch this.
But yeah, absolutely, the budget was being reviewed, the stories about what an egomaniac and what a prick Cimino was and what a crazy person he was. And honestly, I think it was just...
And everything I've seen and read suggests that that might be the case.
Right.
But I don't understand how Deer Hunter,
right.
in 78, does this, and then a mere 2 years later, yeah. or is it the case that in America, we build you up only to knock you down?
Well, 100%. That's true.
Yeah.
100%. Just read the reviews for The Hateful Eight. But I think you're definitely onto something in terms of it being just a different climate 2 years later. And I think Cimino ended up being the guy who had to pay for New York, New York.
And I was going to say, this sounds pretentious pretentious, but he paid for all of Hollywood's sins.
He did. You read, Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, and it's like, oh my God, these guys, they were so amazing. They made all these amazing films. And then every one of them got to their New York, New York, or whatever, you know. But every one
the
of them.
The film that they let you make because you.
Right. And every one of them got past it for the most part. Except for Cimino, that was kind of, I mean, he still made a couple more movies.
And but I haven't seen The Sicilian, much to my regret.
Nor have I.
But I have seen Desperate Hours, and I really like Desperate Hours. And I've seen Year of the Dragon.
I've seen Year of the Dragon.
And I really like Year of the Dragon.
Yeah, I liked Year of the Dragon. I've only seen Desperate Hours once, and I remember feeling like it was a movie made on cocaine. I just felt like this is, it's so hypered into a frenzy and histrionic to being way beyond anything that's even stylized naturalism that I was like, what the fuck is this?
But think about it. Part of his oeuvre, if you will, is that he takes this thing and he makes it very operatic.
Yeah. And sometimes that works. I mean, I think it works in The Deer Hunter. For me, Desperate Hours didn't quite work.
So I'm watching The Deer Hunter again, and I'm thinking, boy, movies in the 70s were so great. But I'm also watching the style of the film and especially the style of the acting. And I think he coaxes performances out of the actors that they weren't really giving in other films. The first half hour or so of Deer Hunter really seems like a documentary.
Yeah.
Very off the cuff and very, you can tell they left the mistakes in where he falls and when De Niro's running down the street and taking his clothes off and things. It looks very improvised and very documentary-like. And then during the Vietnam sequence, when the three of them are being rescued and they're floating on that log and they all have to get on the helicopter. Now, is this just me? That seems to be the three of them.
Right.
They really seem to be doing that.
Right.
That looks incredibly dangerous.
Yeah. And again, that does kind of jive with just the stories that you hear about Cimino. Just like, nah, fuck it, you guys are going to do it. I'm assuming that's how he talked.
The whole budget went for cocaine. We don't have stuntmen.
Have you seen recent pictures of him?
No.
Oh, you should Google them when you get home.
He's
had some work done. It's a disturbing sight.
But the thing,
it's like Mickey Rourke's level of fucked up.
The thing about the rescue in Vietnam reminded me of Midnight Run is coming out on Blu-ray very soon. And we agree, that movie
that's great.
Is really, really great.
Yeah.
There was a long article, I think, in American Film Magazine. The journalist was on the set and got to watch them film, and the scene where they go down the rapids,
okay,
De Niro wanted to do it. The director didn't want him to do it. De Niro did it, and it was incredibly foolhardy and dangerous. And they fished him out of the water, and he was exhausted and half dead and freezing, and he turned and said, Charles Grodin shouldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
Because Grodin was about
right
to jump in. And I always remember that story, that he was so willing to do that.
Right. Wow. And now he makes Dirty Grandpa. So, you know.
Now, we haven't seen Dirty Grandpa.
You're right.
We haven't seen it.
That's true.
We won't see it.
Nope.
Ever.
I saw enough other of his recent film.
It's in my will that Dirty Grandpa is to be screened at my wake.
No, I agree that it is very documentary-like, and for as much as the movie has a style in that it's very much kind of widescreen, has kind of an epic, like...
And the director letting you decide which part of the frame you're going to focus on.
Almost a little bit like Robert Altman. Like, it's not a heavily... I don't feel like it's a heavily stylized movie.
But that's its stylization.
Exactly. But it's not what some other filmmakers at the time were doing, which was, you know, look at this move and look what I'm doing over here.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
not style that's calling attention to itself.
None of the camera work does.
I don't
remember.
And the performances reflect that, where it's almost just, it's so naturalistic. It's really interesting because, again, compare it to Apocalypse Now, which is great, but very operatic. And
very calling attention to itself, especially some camera moves. Now, before or during the wedding, everyone sings "You're Just Too Good to Be True."
Right.
And that sort of became one of the famous scenes. Correct me if I'm wrong. I've been racking my brain all day. Isn't there a comedy film where everyone at a table sings that same song? Or am I getting the song wrong?
Are you thinking of My Best Friend's Wedding?
What song do they sing?
Dionne Warwick. Together forever and
we love you forever. Okay. Hence my confusion.
What's the song? But I can't think of the beginning of it.
Neither can I.
Okay. It's Dionne Warwick. It's not You're Just Too Good to Be True.
But it's not...
But then Julia Roberts and Cameron Diaz play Russian Roulette, so this is why you're confusing it.
Is it Say a Little Prayer?
Yep, that's what it is. Say a Little Prayer. Thank you.
So I'm confused, because the best thing to do in a movie is to have a whole bunch of white people sing a song.
There was a run there where every comedy, after There's Something About Mary ended with Build Me Up Buttercup, then every comedy ended with a cast sing-along, and it's supposed to be, this appears so much fun to have to make.
And actually, I would argue that There's Something About Mary didn't begin that trope, that was a trope that was started with the Blues Brothers. Think about it. We even get the crew. Why not?
No, I'm not. They didn't invent the trope. I completely agree with you.
I would really.
But
like
you didn't
to
see
know,
movies doing it after the Blues Brothers.
I would really like to know what movie started that.
Like, was the first to ever do it?
Yeah.
I want to say it was M, Fritz Lang's M.
Right. At the end, there's funny outtakes in the story of a child murderer, and there's a theme in that
Peter
movie.
Peter Lorre's a real cut-up.
There's a classical piece that gets whistled that becomes a clue.
Yeah.
So one by one, they show all the principal cast whistling, including the dead children, and then the crew and the cameraman. And then at the end, the director just walks down a dark alley, whistles the theme, and is killed. For real.
So
it's the damnedest thing.
Here's something that ties into The Deer Hunter, and I can't think of other examples that I'm trying to come up with. It's always weird to me when a movie ends on kind of a down note, and then we get to the credits, and they do the thing in the credits where they show the cast, like, here's a little scene, and it's usually them,
picture credits,
smiling, a laugh, or whatever, and it's like, it's so at odds with what you just saw. Now, The Deer Hunter does it, and I think it works in The Deer Hunter, obviously, because I think it just underlines the sadness of the whole thing.
Okay, well, first of all, I've always thought that sometimes that's mandated by the studio.
Okay.
And here's why I think that is. A, it cements in your mind who the actors were.
Okay.
But more importantly, and I've seen this happen so many times, and you're right, it's after a downer ending.
Yeah.
It's almost like the studio is saying, they're not really dead. Remember when they were still alive? I swear to Christ, I have seen that in so many movies where they're so afraid you're going to walk out bummed out.
But it ruins both things.
Oh, no, definitely.
It's an artificial happiness,
it's
it steps on the emotion of the end of the film.
It's awful. In one of his audio
I'm
comments...
I'm so relieved to find out they're not dead.
Oh, no. And every time it happens, I'm like, see? Everything's okay. Go... in one of his audio commentaries, John Landis talks about resurrecting picture credits.
Yeah.
But in a comedy, it's kind
of... No, I love when he does
it. It's kind of good.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's a problem. I think if any film cries out for a fade to black, a real fade to black, it's Deer Hunter. I was thinking some more about the structure, because at the time the film came out, it really was odd, the way the film was structured. And then the more I thought about it today, it's actually one of Joseph Campbell's most famous Hero of the Thousand Faces trope. It's, you have to get home. That's the plot.
Right.
That you are thrust into an adventure, and the entire adventure is devoted to you going home. Now, I'm not suggesting that Cimino was playing with this... archetype the way, let's say, George Lucas was playing around with Campbell for Star Wars, but I think it works really well because along the lines of what you were saying with De Niro's attempt to get the Christopher Walken character back, we have characters who are thrust into the situation. Most of the middle part is devoted to getting them home, which is a popular mythological archetype, and then the home they eventually come home to is very different.
Yeah.
and sort of unrecognizable, which underlies the sadness of the film.
And I think part of what throws me off in terms of that structure is, and I didn't sit there with a stopwatch, but I do feel like that middle section, the we have to get home section, is the shortest of the movie. Am I wrong?
I'm not sure. I've never stopwatched it. But my guess is...
You think it's about an hour?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that's probably the way it goes. I watch the film now, and I wonder why Stan and John do not go to Vietnam. I'm guessing John, played by George D'Zinza, he couldn't pass the physical because he's overweight, and Stan doesn't go because he's an asshole. Every time I watch this film, he's such an asshole. And Cimino nails it, because in any group of guys, there's the asshole. And I really appreciate seeing that performance by John Cazale, because, of course, he didn't give a lot of performances because he died so young.
Right.
But after wonderful, good-hearted Fredo, and even creep in Dog Day Afternoon, Stan is really a different character. And he's so... you just hate him. And the first time I saw the film, the biggest thing I took away from this film is that little monologue of De Niro's. Because who has ever not had that conversation with friends where you're desperately trying to explain something that's very important to you and you can't find the words to communicate it to them?
Right.
And I remember the first time I saw it, and I think, my God, I was probably 18 or 20, that whole, this is this. And of course, Stan is oblivious. So I'm looking at the film, and I'm looking at Michael, Steven, and Nick. And I think it's interesting that Cimino comes up with these three characters. And I'm thinking about other films where we see the adventures of three men. And tell me what you think of this theory.
Okay.
We're looking at a situation where the three men are actually...
have to care for a baby.
Oh, I didn't even think about that one. Although that's a comedy. That the three men represent three different aspects of perhaps one man.
Okay.
Because you'll agree, Michael is a very specific character.
Yeah.
That represents a very specific kind of man.
Yeah.
And so does Steve, and so does Nick.
Okay.
And the more I thought about it, the more it reminded me of Jaws.
Oh, interesting.
Where the three go out.
Right.
And they're very different personalities.
Okay.
And they have to overcome this obstacle. And, spoiler alert, I think we're far enough in, one of them doesn't come back.
Right.
So I just thought that was sort of interesting to think about.
Yeah.
And I was trying to think about other films where, I mean, you'll have to admit, Michael, Steven, and Nick are more different than alike.
Sure. Yeah, I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm comparing it to Jaws. I think in Jaws the differences are highlighted because they're essentially three strangers who are learning to work together in the process of the adventure, whereas here they're lifelong friends.
They're very, very good friends.
Right.
In fact,
so those differences are not as obvious, I don't think.
But I think there's a
one of them doesn't have legs and one of them is dead. So no, they are pretty different. Right?
Well, Quint winds up without legs.
True, and dead.
For a few seconds. And then winds up without a bunch of other things. And I just thought that was an interesting point of comparison because I think often films, often Westerns, play with that trope. And, of course, at the beginning of John Woo's career, he makes several films that suggest, for instance, that the bad guy and the good guy...
Oh, boy. Does he ever love that
theme? But...
they're the same
maybe I'm wrong here. I think in his hands, I would watch 50 of them.
Sure. Yeah, no, those are his better movies. Yeah. The ones where he's not doing that aren't as fun, although he does kind of do that in Mission Impossible 2, and that movie is not great. Not terrible. I don't think it's as bad as everyone says, but he kind of does that flip side of...
Well, I'm going back to the two...
Oh, sure.
Japanese action film.
Chinese.
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I'm sorry.
Yes, absolutely. The Killer in Hard Boiled. Yeah.
Where he
and
sort Face of
Off,
establishes
obviously,
that.
Where he's just like, literally, this is the thing.
But there's another American film we're leaving out. Where they're really much more similar than different.
Broken Arrow? Hard Target? I mean,
I don't think you can make the case for Broken Arrow.
No, Face Off is really, and Mission Impossible 2, honestly, is kind of that same trope. Let's talk about De Niro's performance, because the first time I saw The Deer Hunter was probably in the 90s, like in college or post high school, whatever. And I was renting, you know, it was made in the 70s. It had won Best Picture, and it was considered to be like a great, you know, 4-star movie. So it checked 3 boxes for me where I was like, well, these are all kinds of movies I'm interested in. So I saw it, and I had gotten so accustomed to a certain kind of De Niro performance.
I'm guessing a Scorsese De Niro performance.
Right, or yeah, just Max Cady or whatever, you know, because I had seen Cape Fear long before I saw this, that it was surprising, and I won't say it took some getting used to, but it was, again, going back to this idea that, you know, his style is that kind of there isn't a style. De Niro's performance style is so naturalistic that you're just like, well, he's not even acting, right? And yet he is.
I think it's one of his best performances.
It's super good, but
hands
again
down.
It doesn't call attention to itself. And I think, and maybe this isn't fair because I don't know how other people watch movies, but I think sometimes things that don't underline themselves, people dismiss.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That people wouldn't point to that and say that's one of his best performances because he's not big and over the top. Which isn't to say that he's bad when he's those things.
Personal confession.
Okay.
The first time I saw this, I was so taken with it and so taken with De Niro's character, I tried to trim my beard the way he does.
Nice.
It's not a goatee. It's not a full beard.
Okay.
I actually went to the woman who cut my hair, this is back when I had hair, with a picture of De Niro and said, I want you to do this. But my face is not shaped the way De Niro's face was, and it was impossible to do.
I did the same thing when Taxi Driver came out.
I so wanted that. It's a beard with a piece missing. And it's a goatee, but it's not a goatee.
Right.
It's like super goatee. but I think what you're saying about De Niro could be extended to every other actor, even the tiny supporting roles. It's transparent.
Yeah.
If you hadn't seen them in other movies, you would almost think it was a documentary.
That you're just dropping in on these people's lives. And again, that's what makes it, I think, so interesting. The Vietnam stuff is fine. And like you said, that Russian roulette sequence is very powerful. And obviously it gives the movie kind of its central purpose and metaphor. To me, the most interesting stuff is the first and last hour, you know.
And I wanted to talk about the thing at the end.
Okay. The thing being what? God Bless America?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I find it so moving.
I can't decide how I feel about it.
And the first time I saw it, I'm thinking, there is no logical reason why this should work. And I think it works. And this is not a tangent. I'm actually making a point. There's a film by Richard Rush called The Stuntman.
Yeah.
It's with Peter O'Toole and Steve Railsback. And it's this amazingly great film that no one talks about anymore. And The Stuntman is about the making of a film and features many arguments between Peter O'Toole as the director and, if you give me a second, I'll think of his name. In the 80s, he changed his name. He's Belushi's boss in Continental Divide. He's the manager husband of the country western singer in Nashville. Alan Gurwitz, who later changes his name to Alan Garfield.
Oh, Alan Garfield, I recognize. Yeah. I wasn't coming up
when
with
he
it.
Started making movies in the 70s, he used his real name and then he changed it. And there's constant bickering between the screenwriter, Alan Garfield, and the director, Peter O'Toole. And the director's a genius. And the director keeps changing the script and twisting the script. And this is driving the screenwriter crazy. And this comes to a head in a scene where O'Toole says, I'm going to do this, and it's going to work. And the scriptwriter says, there is no way on God's green earth that that will work, and people are going to laugh. And Peter O'Toole pulls it off. And I always keep that in the back of my head, because very few films, we've talked about this, try to swing for the fence. Because obviously there's a possibility that you can fail. But all of the main characters are sitting around a table and George DeZunza is making them breakfast. And one of them starts to sing, God Bless America. And it's so odd and so on the nose. But every time I watch the film, I find it incredibly moving and the perfect ending to that film.
Yeah, watching it this time, I honestly, it was another one of those moments where it was like, oh, I wish that's where it cut to black instead of going on two more shots. Not to the point where it undoes it. That's a nitpick is what that is. But I wanted it to end with them finishing the song, shot of the group, credits. Instead, it cuts into a close-up of De Niro and one of Meryl Streep. But whatever, who cares? I'm certainly affected by it emotionally, given what has come before it and the way that it is played and just how sad it is. But I can't get out of my own head where I step back and I'm stuck with, like, well, why are they doing this? And it's so on the nose. And is it just to be ironic? I get outside of myself and I imagine somebody being like, well, wouldn't it be like cool if, you know, they all started to sing God Bless them. You know what I mean? Like, I start to question that. And so while it certainly works in the moment, I can't argue with that. Part of me can't decide how I really feel about it.
And I think much like the Russian roulette as a metaphor, it is on the nose. But it's on the nose in a way, I'm having a hard time putting this into words, that Cimino is dumping it into our lap. And he knows that it's on the nose.
Okay.
And that's one of the reasons he's doing it.
Okay.
Because he's making us confront the fact.
Right. Here, you figure it out.
But I think it's deeper than you figure it out,
okay.
Because we are presented with these characters that we now feel something for because we've just spent so much time with them, and clearly they still believe in the thing that took their friends away. If they didn't, they wouldn't be singing the song, because I don't think they're singing it ironically. One of them starts to sing it,
right,
and the others join in.
Okay.
And in that way, it sort of bookends to You're Just Too Good to Be True.
Right. That seems to be why that's there in the beginning, which works.
But I think if you think it's too studied or too pretentious or too on the nose, I think, and again, maybe I'm giving Cimino too much credit, that's one of the things he's confronting you with, and he wants you to figure it out.
Okay.
That we're left with something that's very disturbing. And you know how we were talking about how so much of the film is documentary-like? That is not.
Right.
Because I can't imagine any moment in real life where that would actually happen.
So, okay, if I'm just trying to understand.
Groups of friends are seldom prone to spontaneously singing patriotic songs.
You've been at four past F This Movie Fests. You know that shit happens. Let me ask you this.
It doesn't.
And because I'm trying to understand what you're saying. So without the song, if it ends with them sitting around the table, sad about the loss of their friend, we walk out of the theater saying, like, yeah, it's a bunch of bullshit. We've been sold a bill of goods, and we do not believe in the system anymore, and it costs us our friends and our communities and our lives.
But with the song,
we have to ask ourselves, do I still believe in the thing, given what I've seen, given what I've been made to feel?
Yes.
Am I on board with
the song makes
the
it,
sentiment?
The song makes it infinitely more complicated.
Okay.
Because if you're a thinking person, and
which
movie audiences in the 70s were,
yeah,
they've been through hell, and they still believe.
Right.
does that make them saps? Or does that actually make them better than someone who has an ironic distance,
right,
or who is completely disillusioned,
right,
to the point of inaction?
Yeah.
I think that's one of the things the film confronts you with, and I think that's very profound.
No, I do too. I like that reading of it better, because my issue with it was that I felt like the characters were singing it sincerely, but that the movie was using it ironically, and that disconnect I was struggling with, but...
And I think the disconnect...
How you're framing it, I think, makes more sense.
I think the disconnect is the point, because right. I still remember the first time I saw it, I didn't know what to do with that.
Right.
And that doesn't happen very often when you watch an American film.
Right.
American films do not want to make you uncomfortable.
Right.
Or make you question your own beliefs.
Well, they don't. A lot of them don't deal in ambiguities all that often, you know.
Which is a shame.
Right.
Because that's
where life is. Yeah. yeah, I certainly like that. That. Reading of it a lot more, you know. I think that makes it work better for me. So the whole thing makes me sad now to think about, like, Cimino does this and Heaven's Gate, and then Hollywood says you're done, and is there just no room for him once the 70s end, the kinds of movies that he was making? I mean, he does make a couple more movies in the 80s,
yeah,
but they're not these movies.
No.
And is he only capable of making these big sweeping epics that go over budget? And, you know, like, I don't know.
He very much sort of becomes a gun for hire. Although, looking up his filmography, I either never knew or forgot he wrote Silent Running.
I don't think I knew that.
Yeah. In fact, the way that he got the gig on Thunderbolt and Lightfoot was that he had written previous Clint Eastwood movies, and Clint said, why don't you direct? I have never seen Thunderbolt and Lightfoot.
I have. That one I like.
Because when I was in junior high, all the older kids saw it, and that was rated R. And it freaked them out for some reason that they would not talk about. So in my mind, Thunderbolt and Lightfoot has a stink on it.
Okay.
Even though I've always wanted to see it, the occasion just hasn't presented itself. It's Clint Eastwood and Jeff Bridges.
Yeah.
And there's a robbery involved.
Yeah.
But in the film, are the two of them homosexual lovers?
Now I feel like I'm remembering the wrong movie, because I'm remembering them as like brothers, which...
Is there a homosexual relationship in Thunderbolt and Lightfoot?
I don't remember.
That's what freaked the older kids out.
Got it. I don't remember.
And I'm like,
a terrible person.
Hey, babe, it's an R-rated movie. You have to grow up. Okay? I'm eight, and I know this. I'm eight.
Is that being reissued by Twilight Time? I just read that they were reissuing two movies, and I feel like that's one of them, but I could be wrong.
I was so excited about Midnight Run, and there's something else coming out from Kino Lorber that's like, ooh, finally.
I don't know.
Here's the problem.
Yeah.
The minute it appears on Amazon as a pre-order,
yeah,
I pre-order it, sometimes months in advance.
So and you then, forget what's coming.
Right. And then every Tuesday... It's like a surprise. Who bought me this? The younger you, John. The you that was a few months younger. It's a gift from the past.
Yeah, I can't imagine any movie now or even post 1978 giving a filmmaker that first hour. Just show them hanging. I mean, The Godfather does it too, to a certain extent. Think of how much time we spend at the wedding in The Godfather.
Just
show them hanging out, interacting. Like, we'll get to the thing that we're going to get to when we get to it, but without all this stuff. Because, again, another movie would have them, you know, choppering into Vietnam at about the 20-minute mark.
Right.
And that's depressing.
And that's one thing I like about it. I think I've said this before on the podcast. The last time I saw French Connection in a theater as part of one of those classic series. But then when we went to that screening of Sorcerer, mm-hmm, I think Sorcerer does the exact same thing. In French Connection and Sorcerer, you have no idea what's going on,
yeah,
for the first 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And that's the way to make a movie.
Right.
That makes you pay more attention.
Yeah. Yeah. And it takes forever for them to start going across the bridge in Sorcerer.
Yeah.
And then, man, the way Friedkin deals with a certain thing in Sorcerer, he does the exact same thing in To Live and Die. Are you a fan of To Live and Die in L.A.?
Very much.
That movie's fucking amazing. And he does the same thing where you're just like, wait, did that just happen?
I'm trying to figure out what you're talking about.
I'll tell you when we're off mic. To Live and Die in L.A. is the greatest example of that thing that I've ever seen in a movie where you're just like, holy shit.
Remember when we went to see him, he introduced Sorcerer.
Yeah.
And
he's great.
Was so articulate and real and human. Yeah. And have him make some more movies.
He's one of those filmmakers who I could just listen to talk all day. Just even the sound of his voice, I just like to hear him talk. Sidney Pollack was always like that too. I could listen to Sidney Pollack talk.
There are
all
a couple
day.
Documentaries where Friedkin shows up and sort of opines.
So a week or two ago, Heath Holland wrote a thing about war movies.
Yes.
He wasn't really into war movies, and lately he's been discovering some that he really likes. What are some of your favorites?
Let me think. Not exactly my favorite genre.
Not mine either.
But I would suggest Paths of Glory is just so good. I remember it took me a really, really long time to finally see Patton.
I still have never seen Patton.
I'm a really big fan of Patton. That film does some things and does them really well.
That's not part of the 70mm Fest, is it?
Not this year, I don't think.
Okay.
But don't quote me. On a completely different note, The Dirty Dozen is a film that I can watch again and again and again and again. Although it's interesting, Russ Meyer, the famous director of Nudie Cuties,
lover of boobs,
got his original filming expertise as a cameraman in the Army. That's where he started learning how to use the camera. And apparently he once gave an interview where he actually knew the real Dirty Dozen.
Oh, yeah.
That is loosely based on a true story. And Meyer is being interviewed, and he's like, yeah, I knew all those guys. And the interviewer said, so was it like in the movie? And he said, no, the minute they dropped him behind enemy lines, they all escaped. They all ran in different directions, and they tried to get away, and most of them died. But there's no movie there. Had you asked me this question earlier in the day, I could have made you a list.
Oh, sorry. I was trying to spring it on you. Would The Deer Hunter be on there?
Oh, immediately.
Okay.
Immediately.
Apocalypse Now.
Oh, without question.
All right.
Every time I see that movie, and I know you have that famous thing where you're like, the first 10 minutes you're on board, and then...
No. I love the movie, but I don't think it's the greatest movie ever made, which is the thought I have in the opening shot every time.
No, the first 10 minutes of that movie is a...
I'm like, oh, this is it. this is the best that movies have ever been. And I don't think the rest of it
is. I would say it's one of the best war movies ever made for a number of reasons.
Sure.
I like Platoon, but I wouldn't put it in the Pantheon list that...
Do you ever want to sit down and watch Platoon?
I never feel like watching Platoon.
I don't either.
Even
it does what it wants to do well.
Born on the 4th of July is interesting, but I think the only thing in that movie that I really like seems partially ripped off from The Deer Hunter. Allow me to show you how specific this thing is in Born on the 4th of July, because
Tom Cruise's beard.
I'm not the biggest Tom Cruise fan. When young Ron Kovic is watching a 4th of July parade, he sees veterans from World War I, World War II, Korea and Vietnam, and they're either firing rifles or fireworks, and there's one Vietnam vet in the car who just loses it every time there's a loud noise. It's like one shot.
Okay.
And I'm like, that's really disturbing. In The Deer Hunter, when they're in the bar and they're trying to buy the soldier a drink.
Yeah.
And the soldier possesses knowledge
that
these three do not yet have. I think that's very similar.
Mm-hmm.
Kurt Vonnegut once said, who fought in World War II, he wrote a famous book, Slaughterhouse Five, about it, that the men who came back from World War II, who talked about their adventures, didn't have any.
Mm.
The men who had really seen action
didn't talk about
would not talk about it. And I think that scene in Deer Hunter bears that out. And again, that one shot in Born on the 4th of July where we see the guy recently returned from Vietnam.
And I remember the sequence. I don't remember the shot.
He is not okay. I'm trying to think of other war movies that are good. Obviously, I like anti-war.
I think I lean that
black
way.
Comedies.
Yeah.
Like Dr. Strangelove or something like The Bed Sitting Room or newly released on Blu-ray by Kino Lorber, I believe. They released three Richard Lester films that were kind of hard to see for a while.
Okay.
How I Won the War, The Knack, and...
Like The Knack and How to Get It?
Yeah.
Okay.
The Bed Sitting Room is an absurd comedy that takes place after a nuclear war.
Okay.
Highly recommended. There's a column coming up that I won't spoil that sort of gets into some war stuff. And let me see. What else? The Great Dictator.
Okay.
I like that, although that's later, Lesser Chaplin. I'm trying to think of like big war films.
Yeah,
there.
Right.
I think the next time you do a podcast with Doug, you need to ask this question of Doug because that's one of his favorite genres.
He does like a lot of those. Are you a fan of A Bridge Too Far?
I've never seen it.
It's good. Are you a fan of Full Metal Jacket?
Very much.
Yeah, me too.
In fact...
And I started off as kind of not one, and then every year I like it more.
There's something going on with Full Metal Jacket lately. I think it might be that classic matinee at Deer. They're going to show
it. Oh, okay. Maybe.
I don't know what I'm talking about anymore.
Three Kings I would put on that list.
Oh, definitely.
Three Kings is amazing. MASH I would put on that list. I'm a big Catch-22 fan.
Very much. See, and you're going towards absurdist comedies now.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of films that I don't first classify as war films.
Sure.
MASH, Catch-22, Dr. Strangelove, right. I see them more as comedy.
MASH is definitely more of a comedy. I like The Thin Red Line a lot, which I know makes me sound like a pretentious douche, but I do. I think it's really great. I feel like there's one or two more that I'm sure there's a bunch that we're forgetting. You mentioned Paths of Glory.
Yeah.
Boy, that movie. and I don't... Before this viewing, I don't know that I would have put The Deer Hunter on the list, and I don't know how many spots, if I were making a top 10, would it be on there? Maybe. If I was making a top 5, maybe not, but I really gained...
But you could make the case that Deer Hunter sort of disqualifies itself, because you brought this up at the very beginning. There isn't as much war in
it
as some other war films.
Right. I mean, yeah, aside from like needing to see the scene where they break out, where they are forced to play Russian roulette and break out, you almost could make the movie where we see it and then cut and it's them coming home. And, the movie wouldn't have the same emotional impact in terms of our understanding of what happened while they were off camera. But it's so much more about the lead up and the aftermath than it is about
what
takes place.
Because when the film was first released... All anyone was talking about was the Russian roulette.
Sure.
And not just the controversy. In a theater when that film was first released, that scene drove people nuts.
Yeah.
It is relentless.
Yeah.
That one guy hitting the guys in the face.
And again, it's once you've seen it, it's a little bit easier to stomach because you know who gets out of it.
True.
You know?
But it's...
Oh, sure, no. It's just on a technical level, it's very well put together.
It's harrowing.
But it's not... the tension isn't quite as much there because you know, okay, De Niro and Walken aren't going to get it yet.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. Anything else about The Deer Hunter?
I think that's about it.
All right. Well, then that's it. And... Remember, you can find our website at fthismovie.net. Follow us on Twitter. We're at fthismovie. Like us on Facebook or email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Read up on FThis Movie Fest 5 at fthismovie.net. Thank you so much for listening. We will talk to you guys next week.
From the mountains to the prairies to the oceans, white with foam. God bless America, my home, sweet home. Yeah.
Thanks for listening to F This Movie.